This afternoon, this is day five, our fifth day of this wonderful adventure, and our second session today. The title for this one, so this morning we were focusing principally on efforts to reduce suffering. This afternoon, we're talking about programs aiming to promote flourishing, promote good health. There's not a sharp distinction between those two, but something of one, and there'll be some overlap. So we will have, as this session continues until 3:30 today, we will have three wonderful speakers. Two of them will join us shortly. They're still with His Holiness for a brief time, but they will be here. So we have reversed the order. The three people from whom you will be hearing all have been with us through these past 4 days, every minute that we've been together. I'm sure they, as we all, have been deeply affected by what they've heard. So they'll bring their offerings this afternoon through that lens, through that experience of having been here and shared the thinking that we all have shared. New thinking that I'm sure is emerging for them as for us all. All three of them also are strong leaders of strong and well-established programs. They have programs that they're leading very successfully. Perhaps the most dramatic instance of that is the one to my left, who will speak first now. We have changed the order, so if you are looking at the program, ignore it. So I think you know by now that this is Dr. James Doty. He's spoken a few times when we've needed his input. He's a neurosurgeon, an extremely prestigious, very high profession in the West, someone we all look up to. He is also the founder and the director of an organization called the Center for Compassion and Altruism Research at Stanford University, where he is also on the surgery faculty. In addition to that, he's an inventor. He invents new ideas and new ways to solve problems. And an entrepreneur, he then figures out how to get those ideas out quickly into the world where they can be adopted and used to improve people's lives. He's invented a very important piece of equipment that makes it much, much more efficient to study, to treat people with illness in their brain. So he has a very fascinating personal story. He's deeply involved in service to the world. He'll talk about scientific research on compassion and altruism. He'll talk about applications of that scientific knowledge in the clinic, in educational programs, in the education of professionals and others. And he's also thinking now, and I don't know how much he'll go into that, on a much larger scale, about very large-scale interventions at the level of a whole society, getting people together to find their compassion. So it's quite an exciting story, and I'm very pleased to introduce Dr. James Doty.
Thank you so much. Yeah. It's really a blessing to be here with you and an honor to be with so many distinguished colleagues. I thank the Abbots for the invitation, and it's really wonderful to spend some time with the monks. All of us are here to learn, and it's been extraordinary how much back and forth dialogue there has been. Before I really, though, begin my talk, I would really like to thank His Holiness for being the founding benefactor of our center at Stanford University. I had initially begun my own formal scientific explorations into compassion, very informally interacting with some of my colleagues, some against their will. But one of the things that I had been really impressed with was the message of His Holiness regarding compassion and its importance. Geshe Jinpa La, who all of you know, was a facilitator of a meeting that I had with His Holiness. And after a short conversation with His Holiness, he became quite excited about the research that we had begun at Stanford. And we talked for some time, far beyond the time allocated. And really, my goal was to get His Holiness to come to Stanford simply to give a talk on compassion in the hopes that this would stimulate interest in the university. And indeed, he immediately did so. And in fact, it was interesting because he actually called out a monk to figure out what day. Now, I assume when he called out the monk, someone would come out with a laptop computer and flip it open and type in, and we would know what days were available. But in fact, a wonderful monk came out with a very large ledger and opened it up, and we picked out a date that way. But the most extraordinary thing about that meeting was that at the end, he began this animated conversation with Jinpa La in Tibetan. And Jinpa, at the end of it, said to me, "Your Holiness is so impressed with this endeavor you're undertaking that he wishes to make a donation." And this donation he made turned out to be one of the largest donations he'd made to a non-Tibetan cause. And it was really overwhelming. And to take money from the Dalai Lama, I'm not sure if that's a good thing, but I took it nonetheless. So that actually was the start of this center, which has now become a center within the Stanford Neuroscience Institute. And amazingly, not only did Jinpa La continue in that relationship, but for the last 3 years, he has spent a week a month coming to Stanford to help not only with the center, but to work with us to develop what we call our Compassion Cultivation Training Program, which is really a centerpiece of the work that we are doing, learning ways, figuring out ways to cultivate compassion in individuals, to let them help them overcome their suffering. What I'd like to do today is to give a brief overview of some of the key points in the discussions to date regarding changing the brain with contemplative practice, focusing on compassion and the ever-increasing body of evidence that demonstrates its value. I will also comment on such training in regard to broad applications, not only to individuals themselves, but particular situations, and also to society as a whole. My own interest in this area actually was stimulated as a result of personal experience. While I will not go into all the details, I will share with you that I grew up in poverty in difficult and trying circumstances. Neither of my parents had gone to college. And in this particular situation, oftentimes I would feel hopelessness and despair. And when an individual, as I think many of you can imagine, are in this situation, this can lead to negative behaviors, or if you will, afflictive emotions. And a result, this can lead to negative behaviors. And in fact, I engaged in these behaviors, and not only was I at risk for injury to myself, but also potentially even going to jail. But something incredible happened. And this thing that happened actually was my first experience with neuroplasticity. And I'll tell you this story. When I was 13 years old, I went into a magic shop. And the owner of the magic shop was not there, but his mother was there. And she knew nothing about magic, but she knew something else. And after a conversation with her for about 20 minutes, she said to me, and she looked me in the eyes, with these eyes that were very warm, and she said, "If you come here every day for the next 6 weeks, I'll teach you something that I think could change your life. And what she taught me, believe it or not, was a mindfulness practice, which was combined with a visualization technique and in some respects the power of positive thinking. And that interaction led to a transformation of my mind from viewing the world with potentially little possibilities or no possibilities to one of infinite possibility. From this experience, I learned attention and focus, and I also learned that it is only within the individual that we can decide what our future will be. Over the past few days, you have heard from my colleagues discussing evolution, neuroanatomy, empathy, compassion, affiliative behavior, and the impact of genetics and the environment. And another thing that has been briefly talked about is this concept of in-group versus out-group. And this will come to, I will talk about it a little bit later, but I just want you to remember that for the moment, because it's very important in how individuals interact within the groups and potentially how they yet interact within the larger society. Research is wonderful. It's a great intellectual exercise. We can learn a great deal. But the reality is, unless we can take the information that we learn and use it to improve the human condition, it really, to me at least, is not that beneficial. But what are those conditions that I'm talking about? Let me give you some examples. In industrialized countries, or the first world, and in particularly the United States, we have an epidemic of isolation, depression, and loneliness. Can you imagine one in four people feel that they have no one to talk to when they are in pain or when they are suffering? For many, the gift of being a human being who has a memory of the past and a conception of a future, this has not resulted in happiness, but it has resulted in regret, anxiety, fear, and unhappiness. The other interesting point is that our species was never meant to live in this modern world. We are inundated with information and responsibilities, frankly, far beyond those which we were really able as a species to accept. And this has become part of the problem. Remember, cities only began where there were congregations of people 5,000 years ago. Until 10,000 years ago, we lived as hunter-gatherer tribes in groups of only 10 to 50 people. Hunter-gathering was the primary survival strategy of our species, and it had been the case for almost 2 million years. Yet what is extraordinary, our DNA, that which defines us as human, has not significantly changed in 200,000 years. So if we were able to find a frozen person from 200,000 years ago and brought him into our society, he theoretically could function just like us. But imagine what he would see. Ultimately, though, the fact that our DNA has not changed has implications again to this concept of an in-group. Let me start first with evolution. Certainly we know that in insect species, there's clear evidence of cooperation. In regard to mammals and especially the human species, multiple colleagues of mine have spoken about this strong maternal-child bond. We even also see significant evidence for parental bonding. But why have this? Why is this even necessary? Well, let me explain why, and I think you'll see clearly. For humans to evolve with the capacity for abstract thinking, having the ability to have a large working memory, to have complex communication and language, and to have theory of mind, the ability to relate one's emotions to oneself and of others, has come at a huge cost to our species. And that cost has been a very long gestational period, a small litter size, and the fact that our offspring require interaction with the mother for years and years just to survive. Yet there is little reward to the mother for this. But because of this fact, to ensure the survival of our species, there have developed very complex mechanisms to bond the mother with the child to ensure that the child survives. One of those mechanisms has been mentioned already, and that is oxytocin, which is one of many. And oxytocin has become known as the nurturing or bonding hormone. As we extended our species beyond this small family to the hunter-gatherers, this same bonding which had developed was very important for these small tribes to have individuals cooperate and to survive as a species in a very hostile environment, and also to survive against other similar groups who potentially wanted what this other group had. Interestingly, in addition to that pathway, the end product of that pathway, though, is that when this bonding or cooperation occurred, these areas in the brain associated with reward or pleasure actually were also activated, which was, again, another powerful stimulus to cooperate, not only within the family and the mother to care for a child, but within these small groups. Many have quoted Darwin, implying that it is the strongest or the most ruthless that survive. But as you can see by this quote, and what has now been demonstrated in a variety of studies, while in the short term being ruthless can result in advantage, in the long term, it is a disadvantage. It is only those species that are cooperative and, if you will, are kind, which survive in the long term. We have evolved to care. And has been mentioned before, this is our default mode. to care for others. As we have talked about neuroanatomy and brain function, one of those discussions has been about the amygdala as being that primitive part of the brain that is associated with what is commonly called the fear response or the flight or fight response. It is that part of the brain that will take over in a situation where an individual is threatened. And you can imagine the advantage of that. If you think back to that time in Africa when our species was in its infancy and one was confronted with a lion or other type of threat, there were these mechanisms that allowed for the species to survive. And what that mechanism would do, it would activate our sympathetic nervous system, which would result in the release of a variety of hormones to allow us to run fast, if you will, and either escape the threat or not. And if we escaped, we would immediately go down to this balance or homeostatic level where our sympathetic nervous system, again, that associated with the flight or fight, would equilibrate with the parasympathetic nervous system, which is associated with calmness, relaxation of our sphincters, and a sense of cooperation. As I mentioned, our society, though, has evolved far beyond our evolution, and there is often an imbalance whereby we are constantly, for many people, in a vigilant or hypervigilant situation where we have this constant level of anxiety, which translates into fear and suffering. And it is the translation of the effects of that hypervigilance which results in many deleterious health effects that span a broad range from depression to sleep disorders to cardiac conditions to different types of pain conditions. But there is hope, and that's what we're going to focus on. We have really been fortunate now that for over three decades, scientists have been engaged in trying to unravel the effects of mind training on the brain and how to unlock the potential of that training so that it can help others. And as I've told you from my own example, that effect was quite powerful. We are fortunate also for the fact that there is Buddhism and Buddhist meditators because they have been perfect partners in this endeavor. For over several millennia, we know that great time and energy has been spent by Buddhist practitioners in developing a taxonomy of mental life and also understanding the processes in which one can train their brain. In fact, obviously, they appreciated this concept of neuroplasticity or changing one's brain when Western science was simply a glimmer. And in fact, of course, many of you know that for many years in Western science, there was in fact a belief that the brain could not change at all. I would like to give you an example now. I keep going the wrong way. Of the program that we have developed at Stanford University with the invaluable contribution of Geshe Law. We have talked about these terms, empathy, compassion, and altruism. Why are we focused on these? We know that mindfulness practice can give us great ability to be attentive, but we've also seen that compassion can give us greater resilience in regard to our amygdala function and reactivation, and examples of this have been quoted previously. We also know that these types of practices can bring into alignment or balance our autonomic and our parasympathetic nervous systems. I had mentioned that cooperation or kindness results in activation of our reward centers, and here's an example of that, demonstrating the caudate and the nucleus accumbens responding to reward in their pleasure centers, if you will, from cooperative behavior. The course that we have developed at Stanford is an 8-week course that has a contribution, of course, from Buddhist practice, including metta and tonglen. It involves 2 hours of instruction per week and 20 to 30 minutes of meditation practice per day. This is an example not of a study that we've done, but it reminds me that these types of practices, even, well, I mentioned this 8-week practice, even as short as 2 weeks of practice results in effects on cardiac function has been mentioned, results and effects on the immune system, as well as a decrease in those hormones that are associated with the stress response. This 8-week course begins, if you will, and somehow we lost a slide here, but that's okay, with initially teaching attention and settling the mind. The next part of this is having an individual connect with that sense of love for another so that they feel this sense of caring and concern at a very deep level. And of course, for most of us, it is associated with those who we care for the most, which typically is our children. Then the other aspect, and this is a problem which is significant in the West, is this concept of self-compassion, whereby many people are very hypercritical in the West. As a result, they cannot give compassion easily to others because they don't care for themselves. They don't love themselves. So a great deal of time is spent in the concept of training them in self-compassion. The next aspect of this is the extension of that compassion we talked about, that, if you will, that bond to your child or one who love a great deal, to extend to someone you may be indifferent about. And the goal of each week of practice beyond this is to have this ever-expanding sense of caring and loving, if you will, moistening your heart towards the other, and also taking on the suffering of another. We have now done studies on this technique which show that it is indeed possible, and it has been shown in other studies, that you can indeed not only increase one's sense of compassion for others, but the data has shown from the studies we have done that you can increase compassion for yourself. But another key part, oftentimes for people, is that they have a hard time receiving compassion or care from another. And this has been shown that this practice also significantly improves one's ability to accept compassion. What is the potential, though, with these types of training? Now, we know that, at least in the studies done to date, and most of these practices are 8 to 9 weeks, although studies have been done with interventions, if you will, as short as 1 to 2 weeks, that show an effect. Tanya will be starting a year study here soon, a longitudinal study to see the long-term effects. We clearly know that these interventions to date have an impact, as I said, in regard to cardiac function, vascular function, mental states such as depression and anxiety. But what we don't know for sure is, are they long-lasting? Do you have to do, once you receive an initial intervention, do you have to continue with that for a period of time or forever to maintain its effect on your health? We don't have an answer to that at this point. But there are many engaged people who are looking at these areas to find the answers. We certainly know, simply by looking at the effect these practices have had on Buddhist meditators, that they can be profound. And I think all of us are hopeful that these practices will continue to demonstrate these effects. Remember, for these to be incorporated within a larger society, though, they of course have to be secularized. And then hopefully what we will learn is how to refine these techniques so that they are the most robust, if you will, and have the greatest effect and the longest lasting effect. But let me talk a little bit about some of the opportunities here and some of the areas that myself and my colleagues are looking at. One thing, certainly in regard to mindfulness, has been interest in use in the educational system. We are looking at combining that, which is a component of our Stanford practice, with this compassion practice to also use in the schools, the point of which is to give students the tools that will allow them to focus better, hopefully perform academically better. But another real problem in schools, at least in the United States, is associated with bullying, where children beat up other children. Hopefully, these types of practices will have an effect. There are a number of programs in schools that have demonstrated this. It's just that we don't know which is the best at this point and how to continue it on, if you will, and how sticky it is, if you will. Certainly, we've already talked about the effect on individuals and society. But let's talk a minute about business. For most of us, a great deal of our waking hours are spent at work. Yet in the U.S., $200 to $300 billion a year is lost, secondary to the effects, if you will, of suffering, which has translated into stress at the workplace. And why do you have stress at the workplace? What does that mean? Typically, it translates into individuals being at work and having fear. And remember, we talked about this fear response and being hypervigilant. Well, when you're chronically in this state, it is very difficult to be productive. And in fact, fear, a lack of trust, a sense of lack of communication, or finding your job meaningless have a huge impact on your satisfaction and happiness. It's even estimated that between $500 to $7,500 a year in the United States is the cost per employee for this type of stress. And this can translate into what we call absenteeism or presenteeism, where they're at work, but they're not really working. And it has a huge effect on healthcare costs. Every individual who has health conditions associated with stress, it costs 50% more to care for them compared, if you will, to a healthy employee. Let's talk about the prison system. There are already demonstrated programs primarily associated with mindfulness in the prison systems. And remember, in the United States especially, we have the largest number of incarcerated individuals in the world. Yet, do many of you really believe that most of those people are there because they are bad people? I would submit to you that, in fact, most of them are just like you or I, yet they have not been shown nurturing and caring in their lives. Imagine, though, if we can bring these practices to the prison systems. What are the biggest problems in the prison system? One is recidivism. Prisoners come back repeatedly once they're released. The other is violence. Violence in prisons is a huge problem. We already see, though, with just the implementation of mindfulness practice in select areas, we can decrease the rate of violence by 50 to 75%. Let me give you another interesting example of a program that also looks to open the heart of individuals. In a select group of prisoners who had been written off for not caring, for being violent, for being mean, they were given the opportunity to do two things. One was to train a service animal. And in the training of this service animal, in the U.S. what we have are animals that have been trained specifically to care for impaired or disabled individuals or blind individuals. So animals are trained either as guide dogs or service dogs to pick up things or to direct an individual to a certain place. So these are called service animals. So in this particular case, prisoners were, number one, given the opportunity to raise, care for, and help train an animal. The effect of that action itself, whereby these individuals were given the opportunity to care for another, allowed them to open their hearts and become completely engaged. But what's more extraordinary about this, though, is that while this opened their hearts and they grew attached to the animal, what was the thing that they ultimately had to do? They had to give it up. Yet what did they learn? They learned love, they learned connection, and then they learned how to give it away. And that interaction had a huge impact. It gave them their dignity back. It gave them a sense that they could be loved by this animal. And it gave them a sense that they could give love by giving this animal away. An extraordinary example of the potential of these types of interventions. One of the things that we're engaged in now at Stanford is actually working with veterans who have come back from these conflicts and have post-traumatic stress disorder. Sona had talked about degrees of scientific rigor, and what I will tell you is not scientific rigor, it is more of testimonial, but we are beginning to actually design experiments to test the effect. But we have now taken multiple groups of veterans who have been clearly diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder and have had them go through our training. And again, at least anecdotally, these interventions have been remarkable. And if you know anything about post-traumatic stress disorder, this is a condition that is extraordinarily difficult to treat. Medications have not been particularly useful. Different types of psychological interventions have been tried and have had limited utility. But at least it appears in this early work that we've done, and I think others are doing now, it seems to have a significant effect where people are able to monitor and regulate their emotions better. They have a sense of an understanding within their mind of connection to others and its importance and its value to them, and are able now to, instead of blocking off a connection with another or being fearful, to have a more open-hearted approach. In closing, I would like to talk about something on a little bit of a larger scale, which gets to this in-group and out-group problem. As you heard from my earlier conversation when we talked about in-group, and there was a study that was done, it is limited. We can give this intranasal oxytocin, and within your small defined in-group, it's wonderful to make you feel like you want to hug somebody, that you love them. We talked about an economic game. We gave all your money to that person. The problem is, and this is where this evolution comes in, where we talk about our DNA not being changed from 200,000 years ago when we were hunter-gatherers, it's limited to this small group. The challenge for all of us, and hopefully that we are going to find as we learn more about brain function and these different types of intervention, can we extend and enlarge our in-group to encompass all sentient beings? When there was a slide that was shown, I think, by Richie, that talked about the heart of compassion. The problems that our society faces are not existential problems. These are problems of the heart, whether it's global warming, whether it's ecological destruction, whether it's war, whether it is poverty. These are manifestations of problems of the human heart. And until we focus our technology and our science on these areas within ourselves, these problems are not going to be solved. His Holiness has said, compassion and kindness are not luxuries. They are necessities if our species is to survive. And I would end on that note, and I believe every neuroscientist here, and I think probably everyone in this room, appreciates this reality. And I am hopeful that with the caliber of scientists and with the heart of the individuals in this room, that we can address these problems and hopefully expand our in-group, so that your in-group isn't the person next door. Your in-group is that person across the ocean. Your world isn't limited to what you can see outside of your yard. It is the whole world. And when we are able to do that, then our species will flourish. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Dr. Doty, for those really heartfelt and heartwarming remarks. Really appreciate them. Now, while he looks for his, you need help? Could we have AV help, please, to get this set up? Thank you. And thank you. He needs to find the slides. So I will introduce. So this is Geshe Lobsang Negi, who is at Drepung Losling Monastery Incorporated in Atlanta, Georgia, at Emory University. And there he is director of the Emory Tibet Partnership. Ah, here's our Ned, who never fails. Director of the Emory Tibet Partnership and the Emory Tibet Science Initiative. We've heard about that on the first evening. He brings together in his own person and is in his own intellectual formation the two great traditions that we are here today and this week to explore. He has the Geshe Lamapa degree from this very institution.
It's on.
And now you're ready to go. Good. And a PhD from Emory University. He's developing and leading a cognitively based compassion training program. And he's studying it systematically, as I understand, and will be telling us about that work. Am I correct? More or less. We'll find out what he'll do. Thank you.
His Eminence, Jang Shuji Rinpoche, Venerable Abbots, Rinpoches, Venerable Sangha, eminent scientists and scholars. It is a privilege for me to share a little bit about what we have been doing at Emory University for the last several years based on a program called Cognitively Based Compassion Training. It's a training that I will say a little bit about associated with some of the findings applying this particular meditation, what kind of benefits we have found so far. In 1998, His Holiness the Dalai Lama visited Emory University to commence, to deliver the commencement speech. The commencement speech is a speech for the students who would be graduating from the university. And there, in the speech, His Holiness said that, "I believe that education is like an instrument. Whether that instrument is used properly or constructively depends on the user. We have education on the one hand. On the other hand, we have a good person. A good person means someone with a good heart, a sense of caring for the welfare of others. Education and a warm heart, a compassionate heart. If you combine these two, then your education, your knowledge will be constructive." And that's where we see a tremendous need in the modern world, perhaps not in these communities here, the contemplative communities, like the monasteries, the huge monasteries here, but in the modern world, particularly in the developed countries, we see that the education system is in some ways incomplete, as many of the speakers in the past few days have pointed out. In the education, what is needed is the education for spirituality. In 2000, His Holiness the Dalai Lama wrote a book called The Ethics for the New Millennium. And in The Ethics for the New Millennium, the ethics for this new millennium that we have started about 12 years ago, we're just barely on the 13th year, there he mentions the need for a spiritual revolution. Spiritual revolution. There have been many revolutions on this earth. You know, of course, the Industrial Revolution that brought a tremendous benefits for humanity in terms of physical means, whether it's in the field of medicine or technology, of course, in the material world. But what His Holiness points out is the need for spiritual revolution. By spirituality, His Holiness is not advocating for a religion, definitely not some kind of organized religion. The spirituality in that writing, in that text, His Holiness defines as something that is basic, known as seen as basic human values that the whole humanity, in some ways, potentially, or some form that is kind of inherent to the humanity, like compassion, like love, generosity. These universal values, of course, the foundation of most of the religions, but not limited to the religion. Those are basic human values. And we are learning now that they are not just the limited to humans either. Compassion and empathy. These are the qualities that we are seeing also in literally in all mammals. Certainly in rats, in monkeys, in elephants and others, certainly that birds and so forth. But it's the compassion that is what His Holiness is appealing for in order to promote this the kind of spiritual revolution, if you will. Compassion is, of course, is the foundation for ethical behavior. Now, certainly, it's one that is most needed if we were to live in an ethical way. So how do we go about bringing education into education these values like compassion and empathy and so forth? As we know that because of these values have strong grounding in the religions, certainly this education that is secularly based would be quite skeptical about incorporating a syllabus that would talk about compassion. So while it is the fact that compassion is not limited to religion, but yet there needs to be some way to convince the larger educational system and the public that compassion is something that is that can be understood on a secular basis. And that's why His Holiness, in the latest book, Beyond Religion, The Ethics for the New World or the Whole World, appeals to the scientific community. As he says here, that I have always felt that if science could show such practices like compassion, loving kindness, attention, all these practices that we heard extensively in this conference from the scientists, that these practices to be both possible and beneficial, then perhaps they could even be promoted through mainstream education. So the scientific study of these practices is very important to show that these are not something based on just belief and kind of faith, but rather these are skills that can be taught in a secular manner, and when it's taught, they can bring benefit to the individuals as well as to the society. So one of the methods for cultivating compassion we have developed at Emory University, it's called the Cognitively Based Compassion Training. And this is a protocol or a program for training in compassion that is based on Lojong tradition, or the mind training tradition of Indo-Tibetan Buddhism. I say it Indo-Tibetan because the extensive practices for training the mind, such as compassion and bodhicitta, you know, the altruistic mindset, as well as all the contemplative practices that we are seeing today as well, like the mindfulness, attention, and so forth and so on, that we find in this literature very extensively outlined systematically in the early texts like the Bodhicharyavatara and many other earlier texts. And of course, certainly in Tibet, when these Lojong practices or the teachings were brought into Tibet in quite uninterruptedly for over 1,000 years. These are the practices that community as a whole has embraced and specialized and practiced, not only studied in a very kind of, you know, through close attention, but also applied in their practices. And that, so it is a living tradition. It is a secular, it's made secular in the sense that that very specific religious elements from training the mind, that Buddhist specific religious elements such as the reincarnation or the life before and life after, in order to cultivate a sense of kind of connectedness with others, you know, that there are the steps in cultivating compassion, that what is called the marsha, or the recognizing all beings as your mother, and that is not just like a mother, like your mother, but rather literally, that this, that each and every sentient being has been your mother in one lifetime or another. But of course, that cannot be part of the secular protocol, so those are taken out. But otherwise, there is not much that is taken out that, you know, that from what is there. So based on that, we identify in those the six steps. Number one, developing attentional stability. As we have heard from Dr. Richard Davidson and others, that how attention is such an important element of our life, that without attention we can't do anything properly. And in today's world, attention is one thing that is kind of the being diminished through our modern day the practices. The average the kind of attention span in America, average attention span is 8 seconds for humans. You know that, what is the average attention span for goldfish? It's 9 seconds. The goldfish has better attention than the humans, according to the surveys. So what does that tell? Also, when the attention is distracted, you know, that when you are engaged at a task and there are these constant distractions to something else, average time for someone to come back to the task, according to an article in Newsweek a few years ago, is 20 minutes. So if you are at job for 8 hours, and then if you get distracted, not necessarily every 8 seconds, hopefully not, but you know that if you are distracted by phone call or you think that you need to do something and like that, and if it takes average 20 minutes to come back, how much of time is wasted, productivity? Now, attention is so important for learning. You know, that for the students, if you don't have the attention, got a good attention, how are students supposed to be able to learning? So attention is so important, but that is where that the cultivating attentional stability is the first part. I will go into this a little bit later. So this is based on the practices you find in the Buddhism. It's certainly not limited to Buddhism. It is a kind of the common to other traditions, certainly various Hindu traditions also. But there is nothing that it is religious in nature. Step number two is what we call the insights into thoughts and emotions. We heard from Dr. Richard Davidson that you know, rumination takes how much of our time? 47% of the time, if it goes into rumination, if those surveys are actually is true, you know, that is, again, it's a lot of waste. But not only that, you know, for emotional regulation, if we were to then correct or regulate, transform some of those patterns, some of those thought patterns, emotional patterns that are destructive in nature, without having an insight into that, without being aware of them, how are we going to change it? So therefore, cultivating insight into our inner world of thoughts and emotions is a very important part. Many years ago, I was at a medical college, university in Texas, and to give a talk. And they have this program or department, I'm not sure actually department or program. The program probably is for medical humanities. And I was intrigued by that, what about humanities in the medical program? And Dr. Verghese, he is actually the celebrated writer. He wrote a very famous book called The Tennis Partner. When I asked him about why humanities there, what he meant by that, he said that what the medical community needed is the basic human values in the medical schools, because without that, they find so much empathy distress or other forms of, you know, behavioral problems. In fact, of all the professions in America, the number one suicides that happen in the profession is in the medical community, according to Dr. Verghese. I read his book, Tennis Partner. Actually, he tells that story through his student who happened to be who was doing intern with him, who happens to be his tennis partner also. But what it means is that if the medical students, when they are taught in the first year, exposed to the dead bodies and other illnesses and so forth, if they were not given the tools to recognize their inner feelings and so forth, and then how to work with that, they simply end up just kind of suppressing them. And then by suppressing them, you lose the opportunity to be aware of them and to work with them. So therefore, the third part is actually that for my Buddhist, the fellows here, the self-compassion may seem a little bit kind of, funny actually. What I mean by self-compassion really is not only kind of feeling good about, but it's about the Tibetan word "nyejung," not necessarily for liberation, tarba. You know, that is simply a deep resolve to emerge from whatever that faulty or unhealthy patterns that we have, whether it's the excessive rumination or the excessive the obsessions, anger, jealousy, all those emotional elements that when you notice through the inside how it has its impact on your health, then through reflections, not just sitting and thinking, but rather through very systematic analysis, critical analysis and observations, to come to an understanding that these patterns, unhealthy patterns though, they can be transformed. And we can do that. Therefore, we must tackle them. That's the result. That's what I'm talking about, the self-compassion. Developing impartiality, of course, is that when in the sort of the standard curriculum for cultivating compassion and like that, it actually, that's where it's sort of the beginning step is often presented from impartiality. Developing impartiality is so important as His Holiness the Dalai Lama points out, that we all have the capacity for this biological compassion. To feel compassion for few nearest us, that's what Einstein also talked about. But can we expand that compassion to embrace those who are strangers to us, those who are even difficult to deal with us? Can we expand our compassion to beyond what Jim was talking about, beyond this in-group, that the immediate families or the circle of friends, to strangers and even adversaries? And that's where the impartiality, the practice in this Lojong tradition, there are specific strategies that are presented to break down that sort of the tendency, that habit to see the world in this concrete friends, strangers, and enemies. How you do that, that's the practice. It is outlined in that it's a very specific strategies. Actually, that from other side, what one needs to develop the understanding is that, as His Holiness often mentions, that every living being wants to be happy and to be free from suffering. That every living, the organism wants to survive. and to avoid anything that undermines their survival. That's the kind of the basic instinct, you know, even the most simple organisms. Of course, that the more sophisticated or evolved organisms certainly have the more of that sense of that. But to expand that basic instinct to, you know, the greater level, that what we need is this the deliberate practices to expand, and therefore that by appealing to that reality, that kind of that it's a reality that everyone wants to be happy and to be free of suffering, by tapping into that, infusing, you know, into one's awareness that reality, it's what helps one to kind of break down that concrete categories, if you will, and then of course the further, you know, that if hypothetical kind of argument, you know, is raised, that why do we need to do that? You know, how can we do that? You know, certainly that the other ways is to appeal to another reality, that is that, you know, the friends and strangers and the adversaries are not necessarily permanent. They are not that stable. You know, they change. So therefore, there is nothing from its own side for us to kind of hold, you know, strong that these are enemies and therefore, you know, they are bad or they shouldn't be happy. So in other words, empathy training itself, actually, I believe that it provides a foundation for what I may call unconditional love and compassion. You know, that if you begin relating to others from that most fundamental of the human aspirations, not what they look like, how much money or so forth they are, what position they are, not from that, but if you believe to appreciate from that fundamental aspiration that they shared, to identify with that, then the other superficial matters don't really, you know, the affect how we relate to them. Of course, for compassion or empathy, you know, for compassion, most important, the most important steps is this affection, affectionate love and empathy. Affectionate love, there is a word, you know, the yongi champa in Tibetan, you know, the yongi champa. Empathy is a little trickier word, in the Ethics for the New Millennium, His Holiness articulates that. Actually, it says, at least from the perspective of the empathy for others' suffering, that from that perspective, it's articulated as shen dung ala misuba. It is the sense of unbearability to see someone suffer. Like a mother, you know, like Christoph was talking about his children, he's constantly thinking, if his children were to kind of fall and then get wounded or something, that it's something that he would feel most, you know, immediately. What makes that is that endearing, you know, affection that one has for the children, one's own children or close friend and so forth. So the secret for compassion and love, not the affectionate love and the love are actually distinguished in Lam Rim Chemo, the great exposition to the stages of path to enlightenment. You know, that affectionate love is that quality of kind of tenderness with which you relate to others. That is the sense of endearment. You know, that. Of course, that we know that from the modern psychology that the empathy is so kind of critical for compassion, not necessarily the unhealthy kind of empathy distress, but empathic concern. You know, that we can talk about a little bit how, and then really that the base from there, that when you witness someone's suffering, you can't help but, you know, want to see the person relieved of that suffering. You know, like from your own child's pain, you would not need to think that I want to think that this person should be relieved. It's this, you know, spontaneous response. Please tell me 15 minutes before. So the compassion that arises when those conditions are there, you know, so what is really needed is cultivating compassion, as Jie Tsongkhapa, you know, the founder of the Gelugpa School of Tibetan Buddhism, he says, he uses specific kind of metaphor of harvesting in order to get very rich harvest. What you need are many conditions, of course, but first thing for the kind of the compassion extended equally towards others, what we need to do like that, you know, that to have the harvest that is equally, you know, growing. What you need is that first you need to level the field. You know, it's likewise for the compassion to grow for all, you know, in our hearts. We need to level our heart. That is, that means that we need to develop that impartiality. Second crucial part, once the seed of compassion is planted in that field of our experience, mind stream, or the, you know, in our lives, whatever we call it, to nurture that is what we need, is the moisture, the water. You know, that so in the even field, when the seeds are planted, when it is nurtured by the moisture and other, you know, elements, then it grows and gives the abundant the harvest. Of course, you have to nourish, you know, to be careful, give, you know, nourishing. So affectionate love of this kind of endearing is what is like the moisture. So those two are the most important factors. I mean, of course, now what I like to say is that this program that we have developed, I want to say that it, you know, share some of the findings that we have. Of course, this was developed in 2005, initially, you know, in response to a growing mental health crisis or the problems in the university population, certainly at Emory. We had two students each year, you know, committing suicide, you know, in around that year, and then other. So this program was developed, actually, to, you know, to see if through compassion training, can we see any indicators that it can help deal with the everyday stresses. I mean, this university, you know, environment is very stressful, particularly for the first-year students. So therefore, that how you can, I mean, the others have spoken, but one thing that for my monastic, you know, the community here, I would like to share is that in the West, the stress, I mean, the stress itself is not bad by nature, but it's the chronic stress that you live in and out every day, this chronic stress, and this complex and busy life, and the very complex life that that modern, you know, societies live in. It is a constant source of stress. So therefore, stress is a source of many of our modern-day problems. According to Herbert Benson, one of the pioneers in the meditation research from Harvard University, that who did early studies with the meditation, according to him, up to 70 to 90% of the visits by patients to doctors is related to some form of stress. So therefore, we need to understand that, can compassion training help reduce stress? How can we see that? So there are, you know, because I don't have much time, but I will mention these two biochemicals. One is what is called the IL-6, interleukin-6. It is an immune, you know, cell that basically is related to the immune. This cell, when it is activated, it makes inflammation. Inflammation, when it, you know, grows out of control, it itself becomes a source of many problems. You do need inflammation to, when you have viruses and so forth, to you know, tackle with them. But the modern life, the too much stress, it's like something like the keeping the car running without going anywhere, engine on, then it will wear and tear the engine. So like that. So you, when elevated levels of IL-6 is correlated, whether it's caused or not, I don't know, but it's correlated with like heart attacks, Alzheimer's, you know, many of our modern day illnesses. So, and also cortisol is just a classical kind of hormone, stress hormone. There is another one. So without going in detail, we needed to study that if after 6 weeks of this training, do they show difference? So the top bar you see on the left, the side, it's before meditation, and the left, right side on the top is afterwards for IL-6, checking IL-6, and the same thing for the cortisol. You see that from the, what we found is that actually that we had control group, but with the control and the study group, we didn't see significant difference. But within the meditation group, those who meditated quite a lot, and those who came to class and did not meditate. So we leveled them low practice and high practice. In those two, before meditation, there is no difference in terms of those chemicals. In response to a certain stress, you give it, you put them in a stress test. But after meditation, you can see that this black line, that is the high meditation group, that's much lower. Same thing for cortisol, I think it was Richie who mentioned that cortisol, of course, that when you are faced with a stressor, something that stresses, it goes up. The benefit of this need to be measured, how soon it comes down. You know, that shows also the resiliency. So there also, before meditation, there's no difference. Afterwards, you see the black line, that how quickly it comes down. Another part that I wanted to show is very quickly, please tell me when there's 5 minutes, okay? Just when there's 5 minutes. It is Tanya and Richie also, they all mentioned that how important is the empathy, you know, for compassion. I mean, that recently in the United States, there was a shooting in a school in Connecticut, and the 20 young kids, elementary school kids were killed, and that six staff, their faculty and staff. In the media, when the commentators, the expert commentators, when they came, one thing that was almost everyone, you know, pointing out was the lack of empathy in today's world. It's a lack of empathy, difficulty to relate to others' pain and suffering, that inability to, that is what the problem. Thus, compassion meditation improves your empathy or not. And at Emory, when we tested that, you can do that two ways. Either you can, the measure through fMRI machine, the brain waves in the several parts, but particularly one area. I believe this is an old program, unfortunately, here. Anyway, there is the very right side, the brain part. It's the inferior frontal gyrus, the one area. I'm not a neuroscientist, but Tanya can tell more. Apparently, this is a brain that is very rich with what is called mirror neurons, that a certain part of neurons, brain cells that help, that pick up others, you know, the feelings and so forth. In this training, we found that not only the meditators, compassion meditation group, gets better, more accurate in telling what kind of emotional states others have through the eyes, reading the mind, you know, in the eyes, through eyes, but also their brain shows that heightened activity in that part of the brain. That means that compassion makes you more accurate in empathy. You know, your empathy becomes more accurate. Now, this is another study study at Emory. We have done with the same. This is with the grown-up population. With comparing mindfulness and compassion training, two kind of meditation, and then we did have a control group also. What we found is actually quite, this is something that Tanya and others can probably shed some light. But we found something different there, actually, that in this compassion, these meditators, after they have done meditation, they are brought to the scanner, and then they are put into the scanner, and then they are shown images of some kind of very emotional images. Negative images, like the people who are in great pain, positives, people smiling, or so forth, and then neutral. And then seeing that if the amygdala, the Richard Davidson mentioned, remember the amygdala is such a kind of crucial part for emotion. And we try to see that if there is any difference before and after. Interestingly, in the mindfulness attention training, after 8 weeks of these are 8 weeks training, that they all actually, the reaction to those images actually all go down. Except in the compassion group, for the negative emotion, there is a heightened activity. That the red bar you see in the compassion is for the negative images. But on the other hand, when you give them the questionnaire, you know, for depression, in the attention, there is no difference before and after. In the compassion, that they score lower in depression. So it tells something that, and this is something I think that in the Richard Davidson's lab also with the adept meditators, I think that they found something similar to that in terms of the amygdala activation in the adept meditators. Since I have very little time, so I want to move a little faster. Can we teach this in the population, to the population who are at high risk, like the foster care children, who have gone through a lot of problems, neglected by their own parents, and so forth? And this is a population in the modern world, in America certainly, that that needs a tremendous attention that we need to give. But there's ample evidence to show that the children who have gone through this very traumatic or difficult situation in childhood, they are predisposed to many of the problems, including depression that Sona mentioned today. So when Commissioner Vijay Walker of Georgia, Commissioner is a statewide kind of organization that looks after foster care children, among others, when she invited us to bring this program, that what she said was that we have no shortage of programs for kids in care, meaning in their foster care, but they all are focused on changing external circumstances. We need a program that brings about inner change, and I feel that Emory's Compassion Program is exactly what our children needed. This reminds me of a phrase in Bodhisattva Avatara that where in relation to dealing with anger, where it says that if one were to cover the entire surface of the earth with leather to avoid the thorns and so forth, how could that be possible? But by simply covering your own feet with the shoes, the leather, it accomplished the same purpose. So bringing kind of the changing inside, that the inner change, inner perspective is what is needed. So here, with these students also, we found that in terms of another, the stress hormone, CRP, it's called the CRP for the short, abbreviated form, and that's also a high predictor for the stress. We found that, certainly in the high meditation group, it comes down, as you see on the left bar, high meditation group. Also, they become more hopeful. Their degree of hopefulness, actually high meditation, high practice group, actually goes up after 8 weeks of meditation. How far we can take? Can we take this to the elementary school children? And in Atlanta, we have among other schools, we chose two schools. One private, it's called Paideia School, and another one is a public school, Morningside Public School. In two schools we have introduced here, and then as you can see, that our the two instructors sitting there and the very good colleagues, and really Brandon and Brooke, they have been teaching in this population. Of course, they were nervous at first, as Brooke says. That at first I was a bit worried about whether or not we could teach these concepts to very young children. But their creativity and ability to grasp these teachings completely blew my mind. Did they really do that? The data is not yet fully analyzed, but what we are seeing is that really quite kind of the same thing with the CRP, that stress hormone. There is a difference, but we need to do more analysis. Some of the insights from the schools, young children, these are complex ideas. Do they really get it? When you talk about the many emotional kind of the episodes that are going on, can you become aware that when you describe to them like the little sparks and the forest fire, if you don't put them off, that it will become forest fires and so forth in order to kind of convey. You need to have a different way to convey to them. Or in terms of the interconnectedness, like your sweater or the food, the sandwich you eat, how many people are involved, from the people who made the sandwich to the farmers who transported the things, the supermarkets and so forth and so on. The children, like the 5 years of it, it says that I have a lot of forest fires in my life, that the awareness about this, that emotional thing. If you really think about it, you can relate to everybody somehow. It's about the empathy, this about impartiality and the empathy part. Where does it stop? It never stops. That's the interconnectedness, that when through discussions and the place when you, convey these ideas, the idea of our interconnectedness, they get it, it never stops. Even in images, that creative images like that, to this attention part, which is not distracted, nor thinking or the sleepy or with the laxity, but just the right. The children, these are drawn by by an 8-year-old kid. So, what it tells is that I think that that what we need is to find a way to see from, learn from these traditions, like the tradition, this Nalanda tradition that His Holiness mentions about, not as a religious tradition, but in that, those information for cultivating these inner skills, whether it's attention or the empathy or the impartiality, compassion, sense of interconnectedness and this, because it is a very, very rich, reservoir of knowledge when it comes to understanding inner mind and emotions and so forth. And from this tradition, as we engage, as the scientists engage with this tradition, I think there is a lot that can be learned. At the same point, I just want to take this opportunity to just also to echo what His Holiness has been saying, and the Geshe Jimbala mentioned yesterday also, that to my fellows here, the Buddhists, particularly the monastics who are now going to be embracing modern science in their curriculum, what we need to really keep in mind is that the knowledge that our tradition represents, embodies, is so profound, so needed for today's world to make the education holistic. That what His Holiness has been teaching tirelessly and through these kind of dialogues and so forth. So as you study modern science, it's not that if I were you, I would think that it would not be just to know what the science says or what the science does, but rather I would learn modern science with the goal that the rich knowledge that Buddhist tradition embodies, how can this knowledge be highlighted, can be brought into more through scientific collaborations with others, to better understanding, to advance the understanding of these practices, the methods, this, so that you can, in the future, through this collaboration, what the Venerable Matthew and has been doing, likewise, that you can, through not only with knowledge, but actually with the practice as well also, that you can advance this knowledge, that will only benefit humanity. I think that's what I would like to request to the Buddhist fellow, now my Buddhist fellows, at the end, in that way, that if we can do that, that then we will be able to make a small contribution towards fulfilling the goals, the aspirations of His Holiness Dalai Lama, to make a little the contribution to his effort in what His Holiness has in mind as he advocates for this secular ethics. In the end of the book, Beyond Religion, for the Secular Ethics, he says that my hope and wish is that one day formal education will pay attention to what I call education of the heart. Just as we take for granted the need to acquire proficiency in basic academic subjects, I am hopeful that a time will come when we take it for granted that the children will learn as part of their school curriculum the indispensability of inner values, such as love, compassion, justice, and forgiveness. Thank you.
Maybe you'd like to read the Tibetan text.
No, they have it. Yeah.
Thank you so much, Geshe Lobsang. That was a wonderful message, very moving message at the end, and clearly you're involved in exciting and interesting work. So thank you for sharing it with us. Our final speaker has emerged from the shadows. Or somewhere, the light maybe. great pleasure to welcome our third speaker for this afternoon, Aaron Stern. I had said earlier that Dr. Doty had a fascinating personal story, and so does Aaron Stern. One of the pleasures for this traveling road show for all of us who are traveling together has been the chance to get to know each other a little bit more, and it's been just a wonderful privilege. Aaron is the founder of the Academy for the Love of Learning. The Academy for the Love of Learning. Those words are very important to the Academy. It's based in Santa Fe, New Mexico, in the United States. The ideas began to take shape in the mid-1980s. I think it was formally established less than a decade later and is now quite well launched. They have a program there called Leading by Doing, by Being. Leading by Being, not by Doing, very emphatically not. Leading by Being. Aaron is himself a composer. He composes music, composer of music, an artist, a musician, a practitioner of music. He's been a dean of a musical conservatory. So he comes from the world of creative music production and performance, which is a different world than the one you've been hearing from these many days. And from that world, he brings a very original and creative synthesis of this question about what is it that inspires human beings to learn and to go on learning and to derive love from the learning that they're doing and to therefore develop more and more their fullest human capacity. So I'm glad you made it. We're happy to have you.
I'm glad to be here. Thank you, Diana. Well, Diana, you began my presentation for me. I come as a musician, and I think that's how I wanted to begin. I'm not a trained scientist, and yet I find that I've somehow found one of my families by being here. We've learned in our time together here that context is an extremely important part of what we do. It's inextricably linked. It's connected. Nothing happens out of context. And in a way, I've been a fish out of water somewhat in my work. And as I describe it to you, I think you'll understand. So being here has actually helped me find the context that I've been part of but didn't know I was part of. So that's actually thrilling, and it brings great support and clarity. So I wanted to begin a little bit, speaking of context, to speak about how I began my work. I was born just after World War II, and I think it was very much still in the atmosphere. I was born in the United States, and you know, that was at the end of it, it was the culmination of two great world wars that, as His Holiness spoke of earlier today, many people lost their lives, great destruction. And I think it had a tremendous effect on our consciousness. So not only did it culminate with the explosion of nuclear bombs and the devastation that that created, but I think it actually rippled into the way we think and how what we feel. And I think it's still rippling somehow. And I think as we, as I grew up, I'm the same age as Arthur. I don't have the shiny part, but I'm sure that'll come. But as I grew up, I was living in an environment that was in the aftermath of that explosion and that devastation. And I think the part of the impact of that was we began to see tremendous amounts of social and political upheaval worldwide, but certainly in the West and certainly in the United States. And that also was religious. Religious institutions began to go into a kind of a disorientation. Some of the things that we thought were going to get us where we were trying to get seemed to fail us. And institutionalized, everything was being called into question. The boundaries began to dissipate. It's almost as if once we exploded that bomb, we realized that we were capable of doing anything. And it's as if nothing mattered anymore on a certain level. So experimentation was abounding. Disintegration was happening. There was a trek to the east, you know, just to echo our last presenter, there was something that brought us to the East, I think. In fact, that happened even earlier in the 20th century. As we were looking for sanity, I think, solutions, sanity, basic things about how can we become better at being human beings, how can we find that warm-heartedness that His Holiness talks about, that we know we're capable of, but in an unregulated world, it seems impossible to find. So that was the world I grew up in, and my family was an echo of that, since they were in that world. And one of the characteristics, may I have some of that water?
Yeah, somebody's, I think you.
It was for me.
It's shared.
It's group water.
It's part of the community.
was this unbounded materialism.
Yeah.
So it's as if since we weren't quite capable of solving the problems internally, we sort of filled the gap with materialism, television, movies, acquisitiveness. It's a very wonderful English word, meaning the acquiring of more and more and more and more and more. And I think that was the basic atmosphere of my upbringing. And inwardly, there I was, this young kid who loved music, passionately felt everything. So everything seemed to register. And I didn't have a lot of capacity to stop the registration. I didn't want to. I felt. So I think the rippling from the explosions that ended World War II and the just the chaos that was in our culture was something that I felt deeply. And also that extreme materialism was something that in the middle class that I lived in, or upwardly mobile America, was having an effect. Inwardly, and I keep pointing this way because it set up an experimental part of me that lives until this day and is really at the center of my work, which I'll speak about shortly. But that that disconnect between what I was observing and experiencing in the world and this deep sense of longing for sanity, that's the only word I can use, and knowing that there was something of meaning, something of purpose that was not being fulfilled. The disconnect was so strong for me, and it was actually quite painful and confusing and disorienting. So I would go to the piano. I liked when Arthur talked about Einstein going to the piano. I fancy myself playing Bach in the morning. And it brought some sense of order to my life, and it also gave me a mode of expression. Early in my life, though a musician, I recognized also that there was something more I needed to do in this world that had more to do with human development. I didn't quite know the term human development, but I was trying to understand how things worked, how I worked, and how the world worked, but how I worked, and what would grow me. And I was quite aware, even when I was 9 and 10 years old, of a tendency to throw myself into experience to learn. I just didn't do very well with books. I didn't do very well with taxonomies. I just didn't. I was into experience, and I needed to jump into life and do. Well, I'm going to fast forward now, really a big leap, because by the time I was in my late 20s, I had managed somehow or another to become the dean of a music college. And you all know what a music college is. It's where you study music seriously to have a career as a professional musician, and you could become a great pianist or a great composer or a great violinist or whatever. And I found myself the dean of this wonderful music college, the second oldest college in the United States, very serious. And a conservatory of music has the job of conserving traditions. That's its job. And at the same time, it's about the creation of new music. So it has this twin task of conserving traditions and also creating something new. And along that time in my life, while at the conservatory, I became very interested in how students learned. And though, of course, I loved music, the human development part of me actually was kicking in and coming into the foreground. And I became very, very interested in what I was seeing and how the students learned. And in particular, I could see that there was one group of students who were very skilled at playing very quickly on the piano, and they had great advantage as children. They studied music, they studied all of the scales and arpeggios, this is fancy language, and they were going 200 miles an hour on the piano, and they were dazzling, and they were utterly mechanical, and they were dead musically. It was this very curious paradox for me. Technically brilliant, musically dead. Then there was this other group of students who would come, and those students were passionate music makers, passionate, but they had no technical capacity whatsoever, but passionate. And one thing I observed about those students was they could take risks and make musical solutions to musical problems that none of the technically excellent students would ever think to do. Now that really interested me. They would end a musical phrase in a way that I would never imagine, nor would any of the trained musicians ever imagine. And I thought to myself, that's the kind of thinking, that's the kind of problem solving, that's the kind of creativity that we're going to need if we are going to find our way to a better world. If we keep repeating and repeating and repeating and repeating without that leap into the unknown, into something new, we perhaps will stay in the same terrible situation that created the explosions at the end of World War II. So that became my question, and that became the foundation of an inquiry. And then I came east on a journey, and while I was here in the east, I found myself in a cave. This is actually a true story. And I was sitting in a cave, and I got lost, disconnected from the group with whom I traveled. And as I sat there, I had the thought, I know what I will do with the rest of my life. And I was then 30. And I said, I am going to create a whole school of education that's built on that basic insight, that basic understanding about how to teach in such a way that we don't lose the originality, the possibility for something new to come. And I came back to the United States, and within 3 months, I met the most, probably one or two of the most important musicians in Western culture and Western civilization of the 20th century, a very amazing man called Leonard Bernstein, who was a conductor and a composer, and he wrote many famous pieces, operas and symphonies and Broadway shows and many, many different things. But he was also an educator, a very deeply committed educator. And so I met my mentor. And I remember when I met him, I was sitting with him on the roof of an apartment on West End Avenue in Manhattan, in New York City. And there we sat together, and the dinner was for me to meet Bernstein and another very famous composer named Aaron Copland, which for me was, my God, it was heaven. And so there I sat. And when I met Bernstein, I came in with these papers, you know, all of what we used to call the dot matrix printer printouts from my computer, early computers, and reams of paper, and I'm pulling them out, and I'm like our scientists have been showing us how everything works. I was showing him how my educational methods worked and where they led people and why it mattered, and he sat there looking at me, and at a certain point he said, well, I think we're going to have to spend a lot of time together, and we did. And for the next 10 years until he died, I spent those 10 years with him. And we co-conceived what is the Academy for the Love of Learning, the organization I'm going to speak a little bit about now. So I think with that, I'm going to put on the first slide, and I will confess to you.
You just say a little more about all the layers of meaning, and I think we're going to have to spend a lot of time together.
What
he meant by it, yeah.
Oh, God.
You could read it a lot of different ways.
Well, maybe the best way to say it, thank you, Diana, the person who introduced us, the head of our doctoral program at the conservatory, introduced us, and the gentleman said, you know, there's one person who I think you should meet in all of the world of music, because your words could be coming out of his mouth.
Ah, got it. So he recognized his alter ego.
And so it's all about recognitions, I suppose.
Yeah.
That's what happened. Bernstein said, oh my God, I see what you're trying to do, but wait a minute, what do you mean about experience? And you have to, you know. Right. So then the battle began between the two of us, and it went on for a decade. And so what I'd like to just say is, at the end of Bernstein's life, his final questions, actually, when he died, he fell to his knees. I was with him through his death process, through the night. Actually, he died in the morning, and the night before he died, we had a very profound conversation about the Academy and about many things. But when he actually died, he actually was given a shot of gamma globin, particularly needed it, and he fell to his knees, and he looked up, and he said, "What is it?" And that was the end of his life. Now, he was always living in the question. Wonder was always at the edge of his existence, at the edge of his life, and I feel that's true of myself. And as he approached the end of his life, his main question was, you ready? Pay attention to the slide. I hope I can do this. This is my first slide presentation, I want everyone to know. My first. And it's not working.
Thank goodness we have
Ned. What do I do? Slideshow. From. Oh, bless your heart, Ned. Okay.
Great.
So at the end of Bernstein's life, his question was, don't we never learn? In other words, can we learn? And in particular, can we be transformed? Can those of us who brought ourselves, all of us, to the brink of complete destruction at the end of World War II, and who are now, we're walking ourselves back now, the brilliant scientists who are here with us, all of us are sitting here asking, can we be transformed? How do we become transformed? Can we become the kinds of human beings that we imagine ourselves possible to become? How do we do that? What are the methods? What are the techniques? How can we measure them? How can we become the human beings that we aspire to? So that was Bernstein's question at the end of his life. And I was 39, almost, well, 40 years old by then, and I had been in a deep exploration of transformative learning. It's a whole field called transformational learning, imagine, and transpersonal psychology, forms of psychology that have been reoriented so that they can be used to learn about who we are as human beings, not only for rehabilitative purposes, but habilitative purposes. So I said, well, of course we can learn. We can be transformed. And I know this from my own personal experience, because as a child, confused by the outer world, recognizing that there was something else that the world was not teaching me, I became very active in my own inner subjective exploration, trying to understand what's the impact on me of this? What is the impact on the world when I do that? So I had a very active internal learning laboratory going on inside. And lived experience, as I mentioned earlier, was the primary, the dominant for me, the dominant interest. It's what I believed in. The lists, though I understand their significance and how important they are, the taxonomies, they become almost prescriptive. They almost can stand outside of us. And for me, the dominant interest and the driving force in my life was throwing myself into experience and being changed and grown by the experience. And that's what interested me most. So that question became, don't we never learn? And my response, well, of course we can learn. We can transform. I still think that's true. Okay. I know I can. I am absolutely certain of that. And I generalize from that we can. Has now become...
I think you got it.
Oh, thank you, Diana. Yeah. Has now become...
Thanks. Good
catch. You can see it better there. A whole academy. An academy for the love of learning. A beautiful campus with lots of beautiful buildings and land. A very deeply sacred place. Some people call a post-religion place. Where we're exploring transformative learning and how it works, how it changes us, the impact it has on us, the impact we have as we go through transformative learning experience, as we meet each other and as we meet the world. So it's a living, breathing representation of learning deeply through experience. Okay. So I wanted to bring some images of some of what happens inside that building and some of the things that we're learning. And I want to refer to, Woodsona, when you spoke this morning and you brought the image at the very end of that beautiful chart about, how did you call it, bottom left? Not experimental. So we're highly experimental, but we're not experimental yet. So we are now just at the point, we're at the very beginning of... the notion of measuring what we do, exploring impact, and finding the places that scientists will be able to help shape the understanding of the meaning of what we're doing. But what we're learning and seeing is that everything happens through relationship. It's either relationship to the objects that we're exploring or the relationships that we have with each other. And we feel very deeply that... with the right context and the right condition, what we're seeing is, if you remember when His Holiness spoke, I believe it was yesterday morning, that as the mind quiets, when we were talking about the different minds, that when the gross mind begins to relax in the conflict that is in the gross mind and the intensity of thought and afflictive emotion that might be living there, begins to ameliorate or reduce and becomes quieted, a subtle mind begins to arise and emerge. And what we're finding in our work is that's what I think we're seeing. That's what we think we're seeing. And what happens is it gives rise to what we call a learning field. And the topic being explored is one, I think you gave part of my presentation this morning, when you spoke about process and content. So the content being explored, whatever that might be, is one domain. The other domain is the way it's happening and the human engagement that's happening with the people through relationship. And what we're finding in this learning field, and we've developed a very rich language for that, which I won't be able to go into here, is that if the context is set properly, that the engagement between people, when bumps in the road happen, when afflictive emotions arise in the face of each other through real experience, and we navigate through those afflictive emotions, those challenging moments, then something else happens and a field of wisdom emerges among people and we can deepen our inquiry into a topic together collectively. It's quite an astonishing thing, and I think as we look at what's happening and our scientist friends help us find ways to measure that and understand the meaning of that, we will find it to be a very important phenomenon. Another thing I'd like to share with you, which will probably look very foreign to our friends here, is we work very much in partners, and we work very much with somatic experience. We've learned that the mind, the brain, the thinking mind, is full of delusions and memories and all kinds of things that can trick us. And so we try to find ways to enter into experience somatically, because we have some sense that the body doesn't lie, and sometimes the mind can, or the brain can. So we are exploring many different modalities of experience as we do our work. Meaning making, finding purpose together in groups is something that we find ourselves doing often. Here you're looking at some of the beautiful spaces that we have in the building for our classrooms. This is a group of teachers who teach in the public schools in the Santa Fe public school system. And we bring mindfulness and contemplative practice into our work, and they're all experiencing and exploring the quieting of the mind. And they're coming forth with meaning and purpose, where really they've lost contact with that in their lives. So I'd like to share with you, as I come to a close here, the basic learning practice that we work with is, if you think back to the story I told you about these conservatory students, one of the things that we feel strongly about in our work at the academy is that we must produce the opportunity for experience, lived experience, as the basic modality for learning. However, we also recognize that existing theory, the taxonomies, the lists, the prior knowledge that has been explored and developed and put into written form is also extremely important in the process of critical inquiry. So we begin with experience, and then, as you can see at the very bottom of the circle, we move to existing theory to inform experience. And in a way, this is the reverse of the way education happens currently in our schools and educational system in the United States. Our main goal is to place this learning as a practice at the center of everybody's life as we walk through life, that we live with a fluidity. We're always growing and learning ourselves with great intention and capacity. And, of course, going to what other people have written about and studied about the same topic, so that we can inform our experience without it becoming prescriptive and our becoming identified with the theory rather than the lived experience, as Matthew Ricard spoke about yesterday. Okay. So, we are at the end of our fifth day. And I'm going to take this moment to take a deep breath. And as Sona did, express my deep gratitude to my colleagues, my new family, and bring us to a final question, my last slide. And it's a question that I put to everyone here. As Tibetan Buddhism incorporates the view of Western science, how can we all take care that the concepts, the taxonomies, the theories, somehow are not mistaken for the lived experience? That's a very important question. And what I propose is that we keep coming back to the touchstone. Are we more warm-hearted? Are we happier? Is there more human flourishing? Is it helping us in that way? Thank you. Yeah, thank you. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Wow. So we knew we'd have a lot of rich ideas to think about from these three very different and very, and yet in some ways very similar and very creative gentlemen. We have 15 minutes. And because of the peculiarities of the scheduling and whatnot, it's difficult to orchestrate a real conversation among the panelists because some of them heard each other and some of them didn't. But Jim, you were the one who heard your two colleagues. So I wonder if you have questions, any questions or kind of thoughts now having heard them that you'd like to share, and then we'll go on and then invite other members of our traveling roadshow if they have questions or comments. Does that one work?
This one is working.
We've worn out all the microphones. We've worn out all the batteries. Here we go.
Well, I would just like to comment. I think
beautiful.
The desire is the same in the sense that we all recognize that there's an inner life that needs nurturing, and the nurturing of that inner life allows us to flourish. And within that, I think, as you point out, and I think in the context of what others have said, it is understanding our interconnectedness and also understanding how to come to a place where we can freely give of ourselves and give love and share that experience. And I think one of the difficulties in modern society that inhibits us is fear. And it's really, whether it's in the context of learning how to love learning, or in the context of just learning how to love another unconditionally, I think that's the challenge for all of us. You know, it's interesting, people say, what's it like to meet the Dalai Lama? And one of the comments I make, you know, I'm at Stanford, and places like Stanford are highly competitive, and they can sometimes be ruthless. And what happens to a lot of people is that you end up putting on a body of armor. When you interact with someone, you're carrying this thing that tries to protect you and show that you're not vulnerable, that says, I have my act together, you know, I know what's going on, I'm successful, et cetera, et cetera. And there's a psychic cost to carrying that mask, if you will, or that shield. And what I find fascinating is that when you're able to let that down a bit and show your vulnerability, it actually results in people embracing you. And the wonderful thing about interacting with someone like His Holiness, or if you will, another enlightened soul, and I'm not saying I'm an enlightened soul, I'm saying if I meet someone like is that suddenly you feel as if you're embraced by love and you don't have to carry this burden anymore. Mm-hmm. And it's an incredible, incredible feeling. And I think that that is what we want to strive for, and that is what really makes us authentic human beings.
So how about we have this group of empirical scientists over here. We have programs that are emerging that are hoping, that are an interesting sort of play on the word experimental. Programs that are experimental, but certainly not in the sense that you meant in your taxonomy of threats to validity. And so, how do we think about these bringing these two worlds together? Carol, yeah.
Great question. Yeah.
My world is the world of the National Institutes of Health and of basic science, and then also applied biosocial sciences.
Right.
So when I joined a foundation that was dedicated to not only physical health of adolescents, but also their mental health, I encountered a number of educators. And I was shocked because I believed that there was an equivalent for education that we had for medicine, which is there would be a National Institutes of Education that funds basic research, systematic research into what leads to quality educational outcomes for children. Why, you know, I just thought it was there. And I was shocked to discover that this did not exist. Yeah. This means that we attend to the bodies of the members of our societies, and we do not attend to their minds in a way that would, through developmental, fostering developmental processes, lead to both positive mental and physical outcomes. So I'm bringing this to the conversation because if we want to advance the sorts of visions that we've been hearing from our speakers in this session, we need to develop, we need to work for a science for the study of education. And by that I don't mean turning study of education into a science of the kind that a reductionist like me might do, but we need to advocate for and develop institutions for the advancement of effective, established approaches to education.
Right, that's a very important point, I think. So we've heard His Holiness say over and over that, including this morning, that we need to bring this new thinking out into the field of education, and we'll improve society if we do it, if we do it well. And we will do it well if we bring this hard-won scientific knowledge that we have talked about for the first 4 days. So it's really science in, it's bringing science as an input into education. But the question of the science of learning is missing. And it's missing, it's been isolated in schools of education that don't show slides like the one Sono showed, that the literature in that field is so far behind the literature in the biomedical field. You know, that's a dirty little secret we carry, I think, and one that, that we need to go back and think about as we, as the Mind and Life Institute moves into this new area with this enthusiasm for science, but without much of a foundation to stand on.
Yeah, Diane, if I might just add to that, as one who's traveled a lot in the exploration of traditional education, public school education, in, at least in the United States, many teachers report that in their formal education, they do not study anything about the developmental stages of childhood and the developmental tasks of childhood. And and most teachers will report that the time they spend in so-called colleagueship is spent actually learning about how to be more successful at teaching to the tests, as they like to say. And the way the public schools are set up in the United States are such that it's a generalization, but it's pretty accurate. There are some exceptions, but the dominant is the doors open, the children, let's say an eighth grade student, the doors open, child walks in, sits down at a desk, the bell rings, the children are all sitting there, the class begins, 48 minutes later, the bell rings, the doors open, the children move. It's like what I'm doing with my hands. It's an industrial model. That's exactly how it's set up. And the cross-pollination, the richness that we've experienced here, the learning field, as we call it in my organization, there's no place for it. There's no space for it. There's no opportunity. There's no value. And so, of course, there's a lot of fear, unfortunately, because teachers have certain curriculum goals that they have to reach. It's this. And it's very hard to change that with the mind that created it. It continues to do its thing. And yet I just will add that there are many beautiful Steiner's work in the developmental stages of the child. It's profound what we understand, at least from that model, and there are other models about how children grow.
Any thoughts on that question about how we advance the research on this work?
I'm not sure about how this can be advanced in research. Obviously, more programs, if we can bring into the schools. One of the challenges we face in the bringing this kind of program in schools, it's not just whether the schools are open to incorporating these programs because of its perceived kind of religious affiliation and so forth. But I think that, right now, at least in the United States, most of the public schools, because there is a certain standard kind of education. I mean, you have to, it's based on, quite heavily on standardized tests. You know, you have to have the grades. You know, it's driven by what kind of grades you get. I mean, I find that with my students, even with the college students, and the courses when I offer in this field, like this, that I offer a course in Buddhist meditations, actually, just started in a couple of years ago, and the number one concern most of the students have is actually that what kind of grade they're going to get it. Right. You know, that's what is. So I think that is itself a somewhat kind of challenge. You know, education system is itself driven by this kind of the grades that you have to, the performance as a grade. I think that the another way of evaluating like the emotional intelligence, social intelligence, you know, this sort of the more, it's happening, but it's not happening yet. So that's why that I think we need more of the research, as His Holiness that I quoted. I think that there needs to be more research, more scientific findings. And if you have scientific findings, it's easier to convince. In 2005, when we started this CBCD, cognitive-based compassion training research with the undergraduates, the first year's college students, and I was teaching them this meditation. First time I taught, even though the students were self-select, they volunteered, and then we just put it in two groups. But I noticed that there was a certain kind of, lack of interest. So next class, what I did was that I brought an article from Time magazine, it was an article on meditation. It said, how to get smarter, one breath at a time. And obviously it's a pun on the mindfulness of breathing meditation. But it reported that a study where after a few weeks of mindfulness of breathing meditation, that a certain part of the brain that is associated with memory actually got thicker. So therefore, that implication is that your memory gets better, and then if you have better memory, of course you learn, you will learn better. So therefore, you will get smarter. And that was an instant kind of attraction for the students. And then the next day you see that they are actually more interested in it. So I think that more scientific evidence is very much needed.
Rajesh?
Working. So as someone who's neither a Tibetan nor a Westerner, so I might even be a minority of one here right now. but something that strikes me as what's interesting in this circle is that instead of thinking about it as science meets Buddhism, it might be more relevant to think about it as two different kinds of virtues that are sort of interacting with each other. Right? So some of these are hard virtues, which are actually shared in both traditions, like rationality, rigor, right, intellectual precision. Many of those have been mentioned by His Holiness. But also there are certain soft virtues, right? So compassion, fluidity, creative imagination. So instead of thinking about it as how can science meet Buddhism or Buddhism inform it? Can we just sort of think about it in more humanistic terms as how can we sort of cultivate enough range of virtues that makes everybody a fuller person?
Thank you. Tanya, did you want to?
Just why do you call some hard and others soft? What makes compassion softer than intellect? The brain bases beyond both are rather
we could call
half
them,
soft, half...
We could call them gross and subtle.
I think that's also a danger. In the West, there has been long time somehow a bias that, you know, like memory and cognition is something more important and more biologically based than is compassion and things like that. And so they have been degraded and not taken seriously. So I think it's very important to make the claim that actually they are all on the same level of hardness or softness, or that they are basically, you know, they are all, you know, part of being accessible to intellect and also to feelings, and they have all biological basis and can be all experimentally investigated in the same way, on the same level.
I'm just going to put on my embodied cognition hat and say that we associate some of these with harder or softer. That's an empirical claim.
Right. So we are at 3:31, and I want to give two more people a chance to speak. Thank you, though, and you've surfaced a conflict that needs to be worked through. Mathieu, yes, and then Aaron will complete.
Well, just to come out of my little box. Well, I mean, it's just to tease Rajesh. You know, His Holiness often says that we should not, you know, about softness, and it just. Trust in my mind, His Holiness said that nonviolence is by no means passivity, and compassion is the ultimate courage. In the sense that, you know, if you think of barefoot Burmese monks in front of the army, it takes a lot of courage, much more than a sniper on the roof to shoot on someone. Yeah. And that has to do, in fact, with the difference between empathic distress and real compassion. That's actually tapped very deep in the notion of compassion.
Right.
You know, when you react to the suffering of others, according to the impact it has on your own emotions, so therefore, the more suffering you witness, the more it becomes a burden and overwhelming. And so if you are yourself in a very little bit not so strong state, you say, why should on top of that take that burden? So, for example, the Buddhist practice of exchanging, giving happiness and taking other suffering, people say, no, I can't do that. I already have enough. What they don't realize is that, as His Holiness says, is now if compassion is oriented towards the other suffering and not qualified by the impact it has on your own self-centered emotions, then it will, the more suffering, the more courage. Yes. Like the doctor on the battlefield, he's not going to cry every 5 minutes. This time he may cry, as compassionate people do, but he's not going to just cry in front of every person who is wounded. He's going to ceaselessly, you know, muster his courage to work.
Right.
So it gives. So that's why the magnitude of the courage will be at the scale of the magnitude of the suffering, and that's why He's only speaks of compassionate courage.
Yes.
And so that's one of the main distinctions between compassion and the empathy that is goes wrong. That's just what we called the other day the empathy left on its own, or stand-alone empathy without the buffer of compassion will eventually turn into self-distress. Mm-hmm. So I think that's, of course, it's a playing of words. Doesn't mean that compassion is soft or hard value, but certainly... I would not qualify the various modality of altruism, compassion, benevolence, altruistic love as soft, but as the strongest component of, you know, the way to be as a good human being.
So you've struck a nerve. That's always a good sign. we're on to something. We don't have time now to pursue it. But you're basically saying, I think, that we're using these two constructs, Western science Eastern contemplative traditions or Tibetan Buddhism as placeholders for a lot of complexity, and you were looking for a way to get, to kind of unbundle those and be clear about what really is coming together here, and it occasioned a big argument, which means you had a good idea. But now we're going to let Aaron make us feel better. Would you provide some music?
Just, you don't want me to sing. And I don't have the right button on here. So. What I do, I just wanted to share with you that for some reason this feels important to me to say in light of what's being spoken here. It takes great courage, I think, to bring new ideas into the world. It doesn't necessarily feel like it at the time. It feels like putting one foot in front of the other. But actually, these are courageous acts. And when I spoke with His Holiness about the academy, he was listening to me and he said, "This is very good. It's coming from the bottom up. It's grassroots." That was what he was pointing to. And the many different kinds of projects and efforts that it will take for this dream to be realized. So I bring that as encouragement. Mm. And I think that's
good.
It. Thank you.
Thank you. Encouragement. Yeah. So we now break a few minutes late for tea. We reconvene for the question and answer session back here in this room as we had done every other day except yesterday. So we will be back here at 4 o'clock until 5:30. If you have questions, for as long as you have questions.